Buck in the forever series of the distortions of mind. And we can do a continuation of this series for as long as I might live without reaching all the different qualities of mind that we could talk about. But tonight's talk is on the wanting mind. And someone came up with a cartoon, knowing I was talking on this or speaking on the subject, and it's a cartoon with some kind of weird figure that looks like a rabbit. And the title of the cartoon is titled Life in Hell, which is anyway, it says, I am one in the now. The only reality is the present. I am totally alive in the moment. Now is the only reality I need. This moment is eternal. This moment is unending. Nothing is but now. And then the second to last frame, there's a ding off in the distance. And suddenly he's devouring popcorn. He says, dang, microwave popcorn takes forever. So, what does that have to do with what we're doing? Well, most of our practice is very conditional, isn't it? I think most of us could safely say that as long as we aren't being too perturbed or disturbed, as long as things are pretty much according to how we want them to go, our practice seems to be pretty easy. But if we're living with any expectation or any dread or any fear, there can be a real disruption in the flow of our continuity of attention. And that's really what this talk is about this evening. All these distortion talks have to do with how we attach ourselves to noise away from stillness, away from quiet. There are ways that we hold ourselves safe from the devastation we feel that the quiet intimates. And how we form a posture around the noise of our mind, around our particular attitude, and thereby live in accordance with that background white noise of loneliness or sorrow. Sadness, judging, complaining, as a way to constantly configure the silence into some form or format so that we will be safe and comfortable within it. And so when we speak about these different distortions of mind, let us understand why we do it and why we perpetually offer the same posture moment after moment, day after day, into the endless of days. I mean, we hear things, it's interesting, somebody came up before and said, tell me about what emptiness, sunyata, means in Buddhism. Because we hear that word and we configure it with our worst case scenario. We figure it as a homeless waif on the deserts of some emptiness. But what about stillness? What about awareness without thought? What about the word presence? Are those words or phrases so fearful? And many nights, we actually touch that. As a group consciousness, we can feed off of each person's intention and direction to hold that stillness. and also add to it as well. And some of us can actually intimate what that quietness is, what that stillness, how that stillness could possibly resonate for the background of our life. We get a sense of that. Is that so terrible? Is that so awful that we have to keep configuring ourselves away from that? All we can do is to look at the ways we constantly manifest and see the limitation of that strategy. That's all we can do. We can't force, through force of will, force ourselves to eliminate that strategy just by wishing it to be so. Or else we would all be where we wanted to be. We have to go into the very heart of what where the strategy comes from, how it's created, what its intention is, behind, perhaps long since forgotten. But in the beginning, there was the word that led to the distortion. And we have to recover what it is that the word was trying to protect us from. And so what we're doing is unraveling the spool. We're taking ourselves back in time, like looking through a telescope at the beginning of the universe. They say that the echoes of the Big Bang are in the universe today. The echoes of our own ignorance, and thereby the echoes of the beginning of ignorance, and therefore the echoes of our true heart stillness, is also together in this moment. Isn't that interesting? So the universe is not so distant. The wanting mind. In some ways, the wanting mind is sort of the basis on which all these different distortions we've talked about over the weeks gives rise to all these different, the lonely mind, or the melancholy mind, or the judging mind, or the complaining mind. It's that sense in ourselves that there is something lacking, a discomfort, an unease. I often call it a discontentedness, a disturbance, psychic disturbance, that something is missing and something needs to be added. Something needs to be added. Now, that something can be specific, like I need a relationship, I need a better house, a better job, something like that. Or it can be non-specific. And the non-specific is really what we want to talk about tonight. Because I'm very interested in how we carry an attitude of wanting. It's kind of like, have you ever just gone to the refrigerator and opened it? And you just sort of stand there. It's not like you really want anything. It's the wanting that has you opening the refrigerator. Yeah, every one of us know that one, don't we? The background white noise of wanting. And to look at how the culture is one set of circumstances which has engendered that background, the background echo of the bang. So, I mean, it's important. Again, it's important to understand how some of this is culturally induced, or at least part of it is culturally induced. So the culture, it seems to me, in this day and age needs us to be needy. Right? It wants us. It can't survive without our neediness. Isn't that something? And so, of course, it's going to induce that neediness insidiously in order for it to survive. It needs us to want. And so we carry that wanting with us. The problem is it doesn't stay in the direction that it was intended to stay, which is external. I want this thing or that thing, because that's where the economy is stimulated. It becomes a sense of self-description. And the sense of self-description doesn't stay as passive as that. It becomes a sense of individual insufficiency. There's something missing. When we want, it means that there's something lacking. Something that's not okay about us. And we try to find that okay. This is very interesting to me as I was looking at this mind state. The sense of lacking is rather disturbing. It hurts to lack, to feel lacking, to feel what most of us feel. So we seek a band-aid to the lacking. Now, the band-aid that we seek is in something pleasurable. Because if we can wallow or immerse ourselves into something pleasant, then it's like we can forget about the lacking. For a moment, the lacking is pacified. But just for a moment. It's like, I need chocolate. Okay? So you take a piece of chocolate and you eat it and you bite it and you're still wanting through the bite. The bite is still, we still want, we chew it, we taste it, we're still wanting. Then we swallow it and there's a moment of reprieve because the pleasure now has been ingested. It's like, try to chew it and not swallow it. You don't get the same. I don't know why that is. Why can't you just chew it and spit it out? Bulimics would have a whole, it would save them a lot of trouble. For some reason you have to ingest it. So you ingest it and there's a moment there. And then the wanting begins again. It may not be in direction of the chocolate any longer. And sometimes that moment can last for several moments when you can actually be free of wanting. It can go sometimes for a little bit of time before something in the environment or internally starts the whole process up again. And what we constantly try to do is to cover over the uncomfortable feeling of lacking through the ingesting of external objects. That's called life. But the lacking is based upon an assumption. It's based upon an assumption. It's based upon a feeling, an unpleasant feeling that turns into a sense of self-description. And over time, it winds itself into an established sense of me, meanness. in which I think I'm a needy, wanting person. From what? From this sense of lacking. And if it's there long enough, other things, other attitudes come in on it, often spooled along with it, like self-pity, because my life has never led to the kind of satisfaction that other people's lives have. I'm left wanting all the time, wanting, wanting, which evokes envy and jealousy. See how they different, it spawns the different other distortions of mind? Wanting, wanting, melancholy, sadness because life has never really given me my expectations. The wanting. Or there can be kind of a base level and an anxiety that is created through the wanting. A residue fear of not having or not getting what you so desperately need. The fear of not getting it. Often, and this is especially common to meditators, there can be a dullness or lethargy that your practice starts feeling dull because it's lifeless. It doesn't give you anything in the moment that's truly pleasurable that you can sink your teeth in. You're sort of sitting there. Your mind doesn't stop its wanting. It simply drives, the wanting is driven outside the activity of your meditation. And when it's outside the activity of the meditation, that means the expectations aren't being met. And to thinking, and to daydreaming, and to just conjuring up all sorts of memories of better wanting days when wantings were satisfied. Meanwhile, because the wanting is external to the meditation, outside of the meditation, it's never brought in, and the mind gets dull in that wanting because it's because where it is, what it's based in, taking the seat isn't where the meditation is. It's lost in the wanting. Sound familiar? And there's a kind of a flirtation with practice. The practice is sort of flirted with. It's not really embraced. It's like, I know this is good for me. I need to sit. And that's why I emphasize posture so much, because the posture of a flirtation is very different than a posture of presence. That flirtation with the sitting. What in Buddhism is called for is chandra, or zest. Zest. Full-hearted intention. And the only way to do that is to bring the wanting within the meditation instead of letting it drive us out, driving itself outside. Do you know what I mean by that? So that the wanting becomes the focus of your attention rather than creating a scenario outside of that focus of what you would really like to be doing if you didn't have to sit. So that it comes into the meditation. Bringing it into the meditation. Oh, I'm wanting. I'm wanting. It's one of the hindrances, remember. And this is the reason. It's that it's like a leak in a balloon. You know, who would want to sit here in now when we can have microwave popcorn? The now's great as long as the popcorn... The bell hasn't rung for the popcorn. It's like the bell in the meditation. We sit, perhaps restlessly, looking out with the corner of her eye to see if he's starting to read his poem. if he's lifted the chimes. I can't keep going. This is awful. And then the wanting becomes feverish. And then, I could sit forever. Why? Why could you sit forever? Because the wanting is gone. It was the wanting that was the disturbance. We think it's the bell that we're waiting for. What we're really waiting for is the end of the wanting. And the bell has allowed that to occur. Oh, now I can... When I was a monk, I think I might have told you this story before, but a monk is totally celibate. Not in thought, but in action. So the mind continues to do its male thing. But when you're in robes, that is a precept that is very strongly adhered to. That's not something that people play with when they're a monk. And it's really prohibited to even sit next to a woman, all kinds of rules around it. But the mind plays on it. And when you're just alone in a hut with nothing going on and you want some inward activity, it'll go towards sexual thoughts. And you could see that ultimately those thoughts were not going to have any release to them. And so so you felt the wanting and the desire, and it was just with an insatiable desire. And as soon as your mind moved with it, it just became almost body. So you saw. I saw. Well, you could either play with it or you could let it go. You could either suffer or not. And the thoughts contained a certain quality of pleasure. But the pleasure was only driven by the knowledge that the wanting could end. But when the wanting couldn't end, it wasn't pleasurable anymore. So you just let it go. And you learned a lot about, and that's what it was supposed to, that's the beauty of the context of all those rules. Not to make you some sort of celibate, hardened, but rather for you to examine the way of that wanting so you could see it. Because manipulative flirtation in many cultures is the way that wanting is evoked, and then so it's really very liberating to see how that quality of wanting arises, especially with the energies of such intense energies as sexual energies. So the primary purpose of the movement and action out of the wanting is not to ingest the pleasure. The ingesting of the pleasure is really to eliminate the desire. Because the desire is, if you ever just feel a desire in you, you see how disturbing it is, how unsettling it is, how uncomfortable, how unpleasant it is, because it's being pushed by a sense of lacking. And instead of going into the lacking, it goes out to the object and invests in the object and the value of the object. Proportional to the degree of lacking is the value of the object. So you can see an addiction, if something is addicted where the lacking is so intense, then the value of the object, I've got to. But it's to put an end, the actions are taken in order to put an end to that feeling of desire. I find that interesting. I find that very interesting. It gives such value to things. You see, if you want to know what you're wanting, watch where your eyes light. Watch where your thoughts move. And notice the desire that's driving that movement. Because movement itself is desire. Now we're going to go into a little more subtlety. But I don't want to lose anybody, so I just... When we want something, that object or the ingestion of that object isn't in the moment, obviously, or we wouldn't want it. So we create a gap between what is given and what I want. So there are two realities. This is important. Two realities. The reality of just being, of just what is, and the imaginative reality of the world that contains the desired object. And then the mind works with the body in accordance to try to fill in the distance between that gap. But let us look what this does to the sacred. Now we're beginning to get a sense that the sacred is. Okay, so let's just... let's come to that as we speak, and then we can understand where this... the craziness of this. So the sacred is... the sacred is in the full access of the first 9 frames of this cartoon. This good Dharma. But the mind's sacredness is in the alleviation of any discomfort that it senses within the now. So it creates a reality in opposition to the now. But that opposition isn't now. It's future. It's what will occur as soon as I get my desired object. But it's not now. So now we have 2 worlds. And most of us live more in the imaginative one than the real one. And any time you have 2 worlds, you have 2 people and 2 objects. And duality is another way of saying that. You can't have duality in one world. Huh? So the imaginative world creates a reality that's in opposition to the real one, and therefore there's me and what I need. There's me and what I need. There's me and you. Because when I look out upon all of you, I see various forms and objects of my desire or whatever. And that's the reason that we... oh, I like you. I don't like you. You're my... So now we get the sense that the wanting is not some benign posture, but it's the very form and way that the egg breaks and splits. Humpty Dumpty. And then we're left with a splattered yolk, and we have to do all kinds of penance to try to put the egg back together again. But all the king's horses, it doesn't work. We can't put the egg back together again because that's just another... expression of wanting. So what do we do to bring the egg back together? This is a metaphor I'm just playing with here. Right? We bring back one world, not 2. so that nothing is outside of this world. Is anyone following me? let me see some nods. We're going out there, so I need to know that you're... We'll try every strategy to get it back. Just to bring a personal example, I was having a bowl of cereal in the morning. I opened up the refrigerator door and there was no milk. There was just soy milk. I don't like to put pressed beans on my cereal. But I thought, that's all I got. I got the bowl of cereal out. I cut up the fruit. There it is in front of me. So I poured it on, thinking, this is going to be terrible. That was my expectation. And I tasted it, and my expectations were met. But they're only met because I kept comparing the taste of the cereal with soy milk as opposed to the taste of cereal with real milk. Not because the taste of the soy milk cereal was bad. It didn't live up to the wanting and expectation. So I said, okay, drop that. Just drop it. Let me taste this thing. And it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. It was. I hesitate to say it was good. But it lost a lot of its edge. And I thought, okay, this is it. This shows there's something here in learning this. Because you see, from the file cabinet of my mind, where cereal is supposed to be eaten in a certain way. Another example is that I come from Ohio, which is corn country. And this area doesn't have good corn. Try to convince me it has good corn. It doesn't have good corn compared to Ohio's corn. So I have to let go of Ohio corn every summer, and I eat corn here. And it's okay. And it's more, if I can just let go, you see, that's it. That the pleasure derived from something is often in comparison to the pleasures derived from that same object in the file cabinet of our mind. But when it can be stand on itself, just for what it is, okay, it is. You don't have to call it even corn. You don't have to call it anything. You know, you just, this is it. This is not, this is corn X or something. I don't know. But it's important that you don't call it the same thing or the memory of that same thing comes back in on it. Try it. Try to take something that, and it's only what we're used to. I mean, that's what's established our criteria. I think that's interesting. We often don't give objects and people a second chance. That's why the the first impression. Sorry. Okay, so you just let that second, open up beyond that immediate formation that the wanting or aversion has created. Just open up beyond that. New chance, new universe here. So it's just being aware of the wanting. Without judging, can I be aware of the desire? Joseph Goldstein, one of my early teachers, used to say, it's the desire that's desiring. It's the desired that's desiring. There's no one behind the desire desiring. It's just the past conditioned force of the mind that continues to crave what it's always known, where it's always known the source of pleasure to reside, external to itself. And so we have to take that external and come back internally. Let me just be with the desire. Let me just feel the force, not so that it moves me outside myself, so that I daydream in my sittings, but let me come back to the feeling, the sense of desire itself. Often my emotions or thoughts, our emotions and thoughts, are often intertwined with that desired object. We're so convinced that we're lacking, that we need something for fulfillment. That fulfillment is outside. Fulfillment, when it's thought of as to be outside, will forever be outside. That's a strategy that never shows you where the real problem lies, because it continues to make the outside the problem. And it will stay forever outside the problem because you feel diminished. You say, I just haven't tried hard enough. I haven't been up to the tasks. I haven't earned enough money. Establishing more external muscle so that you can gain more external satisfaction, never realizing that it's the desire and the pain of the desire that's causing the whole turbulence. And to catch it as early as possible. As a monk, you get, that's it, right there. Boom. Where the mind moves. So practice is finding completion in this moment. It's completing this moment. How does this moment become completed? By your recognition that it has always been completed. That's the only thing lacking, the rest and contentment that we long for. So the way of practice is to feel that lacking, is to feel that incompleteness inside oneself, not let it translate itself into external activity. Okay, I can feel this lacking. So what? Why can't we just feel ourselves lacking? The only thing that stands in the way of our ability to be able to do so is we think that the lacking says something about us. That's where the rub is. It's not even so much the lacking. I mean, most of us can just feel lacking. But it's I am, it's the I am insufficient. That's what the lacking seems to represent. And that is intolerable to the mind's eye. Spelled I. So it sets itself in motion to cover over that sore so that it won't have to feel the self's thoughts. It believes those thoughts, and that's why it creates so much of a rub. If we didn't believe it, so what? So what we're doing in meditation is coming back and dissecting that feeling of wanting, and slowly over time, through that dissection, we see that there is nothing behind the wanting that the wanting describes. There's no tail that the wanting pins itself upon as in terms of a person. Now it's just wanting. There's no sense of the belief in the lacking, because there's nothing behind the lacking that the lacking points towards. This is the practice of meditation. Not in taking the wanting and creating the fantasy and staying external, but bringing it in, bringing the mind's eye inside, looking at it, dissecting it. And moments, there are moments when the I is quiet, when the me isn't screaming. Moments in which the stillness is felt. Where are you in those moments? Point to yourself in those moments. Those moments wake up to the expanse and completion of having arrived. And the egg heals itself in that stillness. It's not as if we have to glue the egg. We just drop any movement that the egg may, oh my God, I broke the egg, oh my God, what's she going to think of me, oh my, all that, we drop all that. And miraculously, the egg is whole. Miraculously. Many of us are doing penance in the form of our spiritual work because we think we're deserving of hardship because we have such a poor opinion of ourselves. And it's only after years of sore knees that I will be worthy, but will never be there. Because you never, there's no way to convince you of your worthiness when you perpetuate your unworthiness. There's no way to do that. You wait for the outside voices of your boss and partner and to convince you of your worthiness, but you're not, that doesn't touch the sense of unworthiness, and it never will. I hope you're tired of that, because the quicker you get tired of that, the more you'll come in out of the storm and join us here in stillness where the wanting cannot enter. Because nothing is lacking and never could have been lacking. Can we sit for a minute or two?